Space 2026 and a plan to rescue a dying space telescope. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. 2025 was a busy year for space exploration, and 2026 promises to bring some exciting missions, like sending a crew on a trip around the moon and back. We'll take a look back at the year in space news and what's ahead with Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, and Anthony Colangelo, host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff. Then, a dying space telescope could get a new chance at life. The Swift Observatory is slowly falling out of orbit and might come crashing down through the atmosphere by the end of this year. But one commercial company is on an ambitious mission to save it. We'll speak with Gonhee Lee, CEO of Catalyst Space Technologies, about the mission to lift a falling telescope. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Last year was a busy year for space news, and 2026 is shaping up to be yet another exciting year on the space beat. Moon missions are taking the spotlight this year, but there's a whole lot more to look forward to. Here to ring in the new year is Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, and Anthony Colangelo, host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff.
Thank you.
It's always good, especially with my, I feel like Eric is the Obi-Wan to my Luke Skywalker. So this is good.
Hey, so we want to take a look at 2026 moving forward. But before we do that, let's take a look back. Eric, what was the big story from 2025, you'd say?
Two that stand out to me are number one is sort of the rise, fall, and rise again of Jared Isaacman to become NASA administrator. That was kind of a saga we followed all year. You know, I think he's going to be a great person to lead NASA. It's going to be interesting to see how he leads the space agency, but certainly brings a lot of energy and vision to the space program, which it's been lacking this year, to say the least. And I think the other kind of big story was sort of the continued downfall of the Starliner spacecraft. We had the political brouhaha around Butch and Sonny coming back on the SpaceX vehicle. Were they rescued by Trump? Not really. But then, you know, a couple of weeks later, I talked to Butch at length, and he talked about how harrowing the ride to space really had been and how close it was a very near run thing. And then sort of toward the end of the year, we found out, you know, Boeing would not fly Starliner with crew on its next flight. And in fact, there was some suggestion that NASA should have called that a high visibility close call in terms of Butch and Sonny's ride to space. And so, you know, at a time when it sure would be nice for NASA to have a second ride to space, especially with the middle of the year uncertainty, Elon saying he's going to stop tracking production, you know, and bring down the space station. I think that was a kind of an important through line all the way through as well.
That's wild to think all of that was just last year, huh? Anthony, what was your big story or stories from 2025?
Mine was going to be the up and down year that Starship had, specifically because I don't think a lot of the drama that we got into in the back third of the year would have happened if Starship didn't have such a rough start. I don't know that we would have been talking about recompeting lunar landers. Certainly that the way that colors the great end of the year that Blue Origin had and looking forward to them launching another lunar lander. I don't think a lot of those pieces were in play if Starship came out the gate doing a great job in 2025. Now, you couple that with what Eric's talking about, you know, some of the Jared Isaacman up and downs were related to falling out and in that Elon Musk has had with Donald Trump. So they are a little bit related, but Starship went through a year. I think I was on this show a bunch talking about every time Starship had a thing. And you kept being like, well, this was the last time we're going to talk about Starship's test flight going awry. And it's like, no, I was on the show a couple times talking about that. That colored a lot of the way the stories and the news played out in the last few months. I feel like that's an important table setting for 2026 for sure.
You know, speaking of that, Anthony, is at the beginning of the year, someone who I really respect in the industry told me, you know, I think there's about a 50-50 chance actually Blue Origin puts humans on the moon before SpaceX. And I thought this person was crazy and told them so back in January. You know, by December, I think my opinion had changed a little bit. And you could say that, yeah, that's quite a possibility. And actually, you know, I've heard some interesting things out of Starbase that they're starting to take that threat seriously. So it really, as you say, what happened this year really sets the stage for an interesting couple of years.
Let's start with that lunar lander is going to be needed for Artemis 3 and beyond. But in 2026, Artemis 2 is going to be the big story for the start of the quarter. Eric, how important is this mission?
Well, I think it's probably the highlight of spaceflight during the Trump administration, second term. That's Isaacman has said he's committed to landing humans on the moon by 2028, and good luck with that. Let's hope it happens. But, you know, I think that more likely this will be kind of the highlight. You know, when we see people going around the moon, it's really important for NASA, right? They've got to show competence. And if there's a problem with SLS or Orion, it could spell doom for both of those programs, because there are other options, potential solutions waiting in the wings. And really the only thing SLS and Orion have going for them at this point is that they are, quote, operational. And this is going to be sort of the, you know, the official validation of that.
Anthony, February 6th is the planned opening of these launch windows. Predictions as to whether or not NASA hits that.
Oh, man, do I not think that that's going to happen? I don't know. There's been some statements in the last week on Twitter of, you know, oh, we're going to roll the rocket out. All of a sudden, they're saying we're going to roll it out in 2 weeks, and then we'll talk about the schedule from there. That to me doesn't scream confidence in we're about a month away from the launch. I'm also picking up on this. There were some people talking in the general space nerd community about the wisdom of choosing that date, in that it would be a night launch. It's going to get swallowed up by the Super Bowl weekend. And so, like, if you're trying to draw a lot of attention to the mission, neither of those things are great. I think most heads of NASA wouldn't care about that stuff historically, and I think this one actually might. And I don't think it's wrong to say let's push it a little bit so that it makes it a more interesting event for the general public to be interested in, because unlike the space race, 2 months does not matter right now. Like, for the Artemis 2 timeline, it doesn't push Artemis 3 back 2 months. They are completely unrelated on their schedules with how much work has to go. It's not the Gemini days where 2 weeks is, well, we're pushing every other flight 2 weeks down the line. I don't think anyone really thinks if it's February or April or June, that's going to change the Artemis 3 deadline much. I'm amenable to, how about February is a terrible time to launch this mission? Not only to say scheduling from attention perspective, but like winter's a bad time for NASA generally. Maybe let's not risk it and push it a little into the warmer weather.
You know, there's a launch window, so it doesn't have to be the 6th. It could go a few days later. And I do think the engineers at NASA want to go when the rocket's ready. And whether it's a nighttime launch or not, maybe they don't care as much. Another factor to consider is that, like, maybe Trump wants to call the astronauts during his, you know, State of the Union address. These are things Isaacman may care about, right? So we'll see. I do think there's a decent chance the February window, you know, we're going to see if they roll out in a couple of weeks. And if they do, I think that does sort of keep open the option of February.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration from Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, and Anthony Colangelo, host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff. Looking at 2026, we alluded to this earlier in our conversation, Starship and SpaceX. Eric, what's on the horizon for that in 2026?
Boy, we better see some successful launches. They've got a lot of hurdles in front of them. Number one is they've got to get version 3 flying. Of course, we saw a tank of the first version 3 Starship Super Heavy booster blow up essentially in Texas a couple months ago, maybe. They've built another one for testing. And so, you know, we should see the first Starship V3 launch in the next couple of months. And hopefully that goes well. They're going to do several more of those launches, probably presumably start launching these massive Starlink satellites. They're really, from an Artemis standpoint, the next hurdle is the in-flight refueling test, where they launch one Starship and another one launches shortly thereafter, presumably from the other launch site in Texas, and then they dock or mate. There's some propellant transferred, and then the vehicles come back. That's going to require them to have the capacity to launch two vehicles in short order. And the engineering of and physics of prop transfers is difficult. So, you know, they're talking about mid-2026 for that test. I think getting it off the ground and successfully completed any time this year would be a success. But that's really, if you're an Artemis watcher, that's the next big thing.
Anthony, what are you looking at when it comes to SpaceX and Starship?
Anything interesting that Starship does includes full fuel depots. The key under the radar point that Eric made is the test of that is not only a test of transferring propellant, but launching multiple Starships in very close proximity and having the ground systems that can support that and the fuel commodities, not blowing up a launch site and not blowing up a vehicle on the way up. And there are a lot of hidden objectives in that. So that has to be their number one concern this year. I think there's two sides of Starship that are complex. It's that logistical side, and then it's the heat shield side. And if they had to put the heat shield on the back burner for a year to get this fuel depot concept working correctly, I think they should. I don't really think that's how it works there, but like, if given the choice, they got to go for this whole fueling infrastructure, because that really is the thing that Starship does so differently than the rest of the industry. And it's the reason that it is such a game changer if and when that becomes successful. At the same time, they're going to be having these competitors flying more traditional looking architectures of a very large launch vehicle in New Glenn. So it's interesting, like kind of side by side that we get to watch over the year. But yeah, I think mid 2026 is too soon considering how many launches they have to do before that, because they got to get V3 flying. And then they have to have multiple flying. And I don't really feel like they're going to come out the gate with the one that's going to get refueled. Maybe they are.
Let's talk about that competitor, Blue Origin. We saw New Glenn fly in 2025 twice. Eric, what's ahead for New Glenn?
Well, they've got to get the flight right up. You talk to Dave Limp, you talk to Jeff Bezos. They both talk about the need to scale to a higher flight rate. For me, that would mean like 6 launches this year would be a good number if they could get that. I'm actually, I think, most excited this year about a Blue Origin mission. It's their lunar lander, Blue Moon Mark 1, and that's a massive vehicle, taller even than the Apollo crew module that landed back in the 60s and early 70s. And successfully nailing that really would, you know, just, I think, change the whole perception of Blue Origin, which already took a big step forward last year, but just sort of further putting this massive object on the moon. And that would open up, you know, using that architecture for humans, you know, this decade. So it's a huge mission for them, going to be very exciting. You know, they've been talking about first quarter of 2026. I'm a little concerned about that because they had to assemble the vehicle in Florida and they're supposed to ship it to Houston, Texas. It's going to come in a waterway. I live about, you know, 500 feet from. So, you know, I've been watching for the Blue Moon Mark 1 to come here to Johnson Space Center for vacuum chamber testing at the Space Center. It hasn't arrived yet. And so, you know, I'm very skeptical they're going to be ready to launch in the first quarter of this year, but that's very exciting. I think they're actually going to end up bumping Blue Moon off the next New Glenn and do a commercial launch next on New Glenn, hopefully within a couple months, but we haven't seen that first stage yet. So really the two things, the big things for them this year are, number one, flying New Glenn at rate, and then obviously very excited about Blue Moon Mark 1.
Finally, before I let you two go, outside of these two, you know, major companies and major stories happening in 2026, what else are you really excited about? Eric, I'll start with you.
There's all kinds of stuff internationally happening, but I'm going to stay in the United States. I think this is a year where we're going to continue to see smaller companies. The really big movers and shakers to date in commercial space in the United States have been SpaceX, Blue Origin, and sort of other companies backed by billionaires. But I think we're starting to see smaller companies, sort of the third generation of new space companies that aren't billionaire backed, but are VC backed, really kind of making an impact and doing critical, you know, things in space. We've already seen this with like the transport emissions have been really enabling, allowing companies to get sort of small precursor satellites into space. But I think we're going to continue to see really interesting thing happen from the commercial companies that, you know, and ground systems on the ground, satellites in launch, in space propulsion, all sort of those areas. I'm just really excited to see kind of companies that have been percolating in the background, but making incredible progress, like a K2 space, right? Recently was evaluation of a couple of $1 billion. They're coming along right as NASA is going to be reevaluating the way it does scientific exploration of the solar system. But it's just, I'm excited to see sort of how those pieces all come together.
Anthony?
On the launch side, Snoke Space and Rocket Labs Neutron are the two things that I'm really curious to see how they progress.
Give me odds that either of those launch this year, Anthony.
Stoke, very low. They haven't set a date. They've just said, like, we'll probably finish the launch complex in 2026 sometime, which to me says, yeah, they'll launch in 2027. But I want to see how far they get, because they tend to be one that does a lot of things and then tells you about them versus just saying a lot of things out in publicly and not delivering. Rocket Lab has traditionally been like that as well, though they've been hiding the ball maybe on Neutron's launch date for a very long time and just kind of punting it a quarter at a time every time they have a earnings report, which feels weird to me. But I mean, there is first stage hardware now floating around in Wallops Island, so I feel pretty good about Neutron doing something in 2026. Whether it actually lifts off or it's just a static fire, I don't know.
Let's keep an eye on Eric Berger, Anthony Colangelo. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That was Eric Berger, Senior Space Editor at Ars Technica, and Anthony Colangelo, host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff. Still to come, saving a dying space telescope.
The team at NASA has been great. They said, hey, what if instead of retiring the asset, we could use a robotic servicing mission to reboost it? Because the instruments are still good. It's still producing active science.
A commercial space company's plan to boost a falling telescope. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Thank you. Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts, beginning December 4th. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. The Swift Observatory is falling to Earth. A company wants to push it back up. The space-based telescope was launched in 2004 to study gamma-ray bursts and other mysteries of space. The Swift team has kept the observatory running despite challenges like gyroscope failures. However, with no onboard thrusters, NASA can't save it from falling back to Earth and likely burning up in our atmosphere. But commercial company Catalyst Space Technologies has a plan to fix that. It wants to push the observatory into higher orbit. It is certainly an ambitious mission and the first of its kind. But CEO Gan-hee Lee says his team is motivated to move the needle of what is possible in low Earth orbit. He joins us now to bring us up to speed on his plan. Gan-hee, welcome to Are We There Yet?
Hey, thanks so much, Brendan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. You are working on something super cool and super fascinating. Can you just briefly tell me a bit about what the Swift Observatory is and why it needs your help?
The Swift Observatory is a NASA space telescope that is conducting planetary science and studying the universe. It's actually one of the most bang for your buck science instruments when it comes to cost per unit science. It's been in operation continuously for about the last 20 years, and it's in low Earth orbit. Over the next few months, the plan right now is that Swift might deorbit because it's hitting the atmosphere. And the unique part of what our mission is as Catalyst is we're building a robotic servicing spacecraft that's going to launch into space, grab onto the telescope, and reboost it higher into orbit so we can continue its science mission.
Let's talk a little bit about the need for that. Satellites go up there. There's nothing really to help them out if they run into any issues. Your company, Catalyst Space Technologies, is almost like a tech supporter or an ambulance service for these things, right? What is the need for these kind of in-orbit servicing for satellites?
That's exactly right. The future of space operations is very dynamic. In the past, we would have these static systems where you would launch a satellite on top of a big rocket and it would blast off into space, and that'd be the last time you would ever touch it, and you would just hope for the best. And that worked pretty well through the 20th century and early 21st century. But now maneuvers are more prevalent, right? You want to be able to move your satellites around as conditions change, right? You might actually have anomalies on orbit where you need to repair things. And all of these capabilities are what our robotic satellites are designed to do.
Tell me a bit about this particular mission to save Swift. How are you going to do it, Connie?
This is a really radical departure from traditional space operations. We've partnered with NASA. They've been really forward-leaning. You know, every few years, they take a look and inventory of all of their major space assets and say, hey, what is our plan for the next few years? And they looked at this, and about a year ago, I was looking like they might have to retire the Swift Observatory. But this is where they got really innovative. The team at NASA has been great. They said, hey, what if instead of retiring the asset, we could use a robotic servicing mission to reboost it? Because the instruments are still good. It's still producing active science. Right. And so they reached out to a bunch of different industry providers of these types of services. They asked us to put together a proposal of what it would look like. How fast could you move? How much would it cost? Right. And it was kind of a really crazy mission. Like you said, it was like, are we really going to use a space robot to go grab onto a telescope that was never designed to be serviced? Right. Like that sounds like out of a movie, but that's really what was asked of us. Right. And so NASA ended up making the decision to award this contract and move forward in September of 2025 with a planned launch date of June 2026, right? That is less than a year. That is so out of normal when it comes to space operations. Typical space missions are planned 3 to 5 years in advance. And in this case, because we have the tight deadline, we just had to move much faster. So we're building a dedicated robotic spacecraft that will launch into low Earth orbit. We're going to grapple with it using robotic arms onto structural members that weren't designed as grapple interfaces. And we'll have three of these robotic arms that grab onto it. And once we're docked, we'll boost with our robotic spacecraft thrusters to raise its orbit from around 350 kilometers up to around 600 kilometers so that it can continue its mission.
How long will that take? That seems like quite a distance.
We'll launch and we'll spend about 2 to 4 weeks doing some of the initial system checkouts and doing the proximity operations to bring our spacecraft closer to the Swift spacecraft. That'll take about 2 to 4 weeks. And then we'll thrust continuously for about 8 weeks as well, right? So all said and done, this is a 3-month mission. It might last a little bit longer depending on the exact altitude that Swift is at when we get to it, right? There's some uncertainty there. That's the importance of the flexibility of the spacecraft.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Ghani Lee. He's the CEO of Catalyst Space Technologies, which has been tasked with saving the Swift Observatory. I want to talk a bit about the urgency here. You mentioned this is a very, very quick turnaround that your company was asked to develop this mission to save Swift because there is the possibility that it may fall out of orbit, right? Tell me a bit about why that is the case, and then what challenges that presents to you in coming up with something to within a year almost, timeline to make it happen.
So just for context, NASA has invested approximately $400-500 million into this Swift telescope, right? That's the cost it took to build and launch and operate the telescope. It is a very valuable asset. And for context, the contract that they issued us is $30 million, right? That's to launch and rescue the telescope. That represents essentially a 10x return on their investment, right? The challenge here is how fast can you move, to your point, right? To go from a design to an actual spacecraft ready for launch in just about 9 months is a very complex operation. And not only that, we are doing one of the most challenging technical parts of space mission operations, the technical field known as rendezvous proximity operations and docking, right? Just fancy technical jargon for getting two spacecraft close to each other. The cool thing about that is we are bringing together robotics, we're showing that you can use commercial spacecraft to do these types of missions economically. And when you're able to do this type of maneuver on orbit, it means that you can start laying the foundation for future missions where you can rescue other types of space assets. We have a lot of space assets that could benefit from a capability like this. It's no fault of NASA. Space assets age, they get old, they get lower in altitude, they run out of propellant. And actually, it's a testament to the ingenuity of the engineers working on those teams that they're continuing to generate science. So if we can leverage robotic servicing missions like this, we can extend their lifetimes, make the science missions even better, and continue to, you know, help the missions along.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier in our conversation. You said that Swift was never designed to be serviced. And so you have to come up with a way that you can actually grab onto this thing without hurting it. How do you do that?
So the technical term for this is unprepared or non-cooperative, right? So we've had to get creative. There's a number of different structural interfaces that are on all spacecraft. These are things that they use during transportation, or these are things that they use to hook up the satellite to the rocket when it launches, right? So we've designed a robotic system that's capable of grappling on to a number of these different fixtures, right? And we have sensors on board our robotics that can determine the locations of these sensors and allow us to grip onto them in a safe way. And we have multiple points of contact as well. We have 3 different robotic arms. So essentially, we're giving this spacecraft a nice gentle bear hug, right? Nice stable. And from there, once we have a stable platform, we can begin thrusting and raising its altitude. This is what we hope to be, a repeatable, cost-effective blueprint for future missions, right? If we can service a non-prepared spacecraft, we can service other non-prepared spacecraft. And by doing that, we'll deploy more of these robotic systems, and then we'll have infrastructure we can build on.
I love that term, non-prepared. I also like non-cooperative. It's funny to think of a spacecraft being non-cooperative. But to your point, you're hoping that this is going to be a blueprint moving forward, because most satellites, if not all of them, don't have something to grapple onto, right? This was not a thought that you could do servicing, so these satellites aren't built. Is that kind of what the future is you'll be able to go to different satellites based upon what you learn from the Swift Observatory mission?
That's exactly right. That's our vision, is for the future, we'll be able to dock spacecraft together routinely, almost as routine as parking a car. And to do that, we need in the future, prepared interfaces. You want to have the USB port in space, right? One of the cool things about this is if you look at a regime of space called geosynchronous orbit, right? A lot of those spacecraft have similar geometric interfaces for how they connected to the launch vehicle, known as the launch adapter ring, right? And so that's what I call the tow hitch of a lot of these satellites, right? And so we've designed a system that's routinely able to grapple onto those systems. So that's the first step of repeatability.
This could certainly have implications in dealing with space junk, right? I mean, is that being considered as well?
Space debris and space sustainability is very important, right? We have to know where objects are in space so that we can avoid potential collisions. And, you know, at a certain point, we want to be able to remove objects from space as well. I think that's of national importance, right? As well as global importance. I think that for a mission like this, $30 million to reboost a satellite is pretty much a bargain if you think about the value you're getting for the science mission. But if you had some critical pieces of debris that you had to remove, right, there's no reason that the same robotic system couldn't go around and grab a bunch of different objects and deorbit them as well, right? So we're seeing the pricing, the cost of these types of systems come just radically down, right? And that allows us to apply them to these different applications where in the past it was cost prohibitive, right? If it costs you $500 million to build a robotic spacecraft, you're not going to use that to deorbit objects because it just doesn't close, right? Versus in this case, we're seeing those curves start to converge.
How are you and your team feeling about moving towards launch day?
Our team is incredibly motivated. This is the type of thing that people want to get out of bed for, right? You think about, why do young students go to aerospace engineering school? They say, hey, I want to go do these crazy missions where we're building space robots to go grab onto space telescopes. That's something that a student might say. And we now have the amazing privilege to get to work with NASA and the US government to attempt this mission. It is something that is not without risk. NASA came into this eyes wide open. They said, hey, this is something that would move the needle in terms of what is possible with the industrial base, robotic servicing. It would have a big economic payoff for the science mission, and it would signify on behalf of the nation that we are doing these types of important missions, right? So everyone is very excited about this. I would say that if we can show that this is possible using a commercial service, right, with very economical resources, then we can do this over and over and over again, and many different groups can benefit. Not only additional NASA servicing missions, right? There's a bunch of other Earth science observatories that are just like SWIFT, right, that can benefit from a service like this, but also military assets can benefit from these types of robotic servicing missions as well, right? So there's a lot of stakeholders watching this, and we're really excited about this. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. We just completed our critical design review with the NASA team. That was a huge push, and the next 6 months are going to be a mad dash to the finish line as we build the flight spacecraft, as we go through environmental qualification testing, as we get out to ship out to the launch pad. It's going to be a fun time.
Johnny Lee is the CEO of Catalyst Space Technology. He's tasked with rescuing the SWIFT Observatory. Good luck to you, Johnny. Great chatting with you.
Thanks so much, Brendan.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at @AWTYSpace. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is aretheyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. They're back for another semester. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.